it's Diane on my mind, Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. Since President Biden took office, talk of the 82-year-old's retirement has spread among liberals, though the justice himself has remained silent on the topic. A vacancy left by Breyer would offer the opportunity for a Democratic president to make an appointment, something that has not happened in more than a decade. This comes at a moment when even Breyer himself has expressed concern that the nation's highest court is losing the public's confidence, mostly due to perceptions of hyper-partisanship. Back in 2010, I spoke with a justice about a book he had just written on this very topic. It was called Making Our Democracy Work, A Judge's View. And I bring you that conversation today.
Good morning to you, sir. It's so good to meet you.
Well, good morning, Dan. It's very nice to be here.
Your book is subtitled A Judge's View. Do you see a judge's view as being different from, say, my view or an ordinary citizen's view?
Well, a judge has a different job, and I'm writing about my job. And what I want people to know is, what is that job? What is the job of the nine people who are there? What has been the job of the Supreme Court over the years? Why is it that Americans have come to accept it as having the last word on the meaning of the Constitution in most areas? Why? And should they? And what is the point of what we do? And how do they do it? I want to go into those questions by telling stories and by explaining. And in part, I guess I'm doing it because my predecessor, Harry Blackmun, told me to do it.
He did.
Well, he did. He said two things. He said, you know, when I was appointed, I was replacing him, and he said, you will find this an unusual assignment. Quite right. And he also said, Americans have an unquenchable thirst to know about what the court does. They know it's somehow important. They know it has something to do with the Constitution. They know it can affect them, what the court decides. But they want to know how it works. So every chance you get, tell them. Explain it as best you can.
So you've written a number of books. And it seems to me that one of the issues that makes the Supreme Court less attainable than perhaps the other parts of government is that we as ordinary citizens cannot see you at work.
That's probably true.
And it makes for understanding how the court works that much more difficult for us. Are you in favor of or against having courtroom procedures televised?
I don't have a definite answer. And the reason is, like so many things, oh, you're going to say, oh, this is a judge. He can never reach a decision. He just goes back and forth. But from the point of view you're talking about, I think it would be wonderful to televise the proceedings, the oral argument. Wonderful, because people would see nine men and women hard at work deciding questions that are at the borderline of the Constitution. They're border cases, and they're difficult, and there are two sides. And what they'd see is judges at work trying to work out what the right answer is. And it's hard, always hard, because if it weren't hard, why is the case in front of us? It would be wonderful if they could see that. But there are negatives to having the television in the courtroom. And the negatives are different. People worry that if it were in the Supreme Court, given the symbolic importance of the court, perhaps it would be in every criminal case as well. And there are special features of criminal cases, witnesses and jurors who really have reason for not wanting to be on television. And then people worry that Well, the oral argument is only 5% of what we do. Most things are in writing. And people on television, particularly, identify with other people. And they'll say, oh, it's this person, the good one, versus that person, the bad one. That's undesirable because most of the people we affect are not in the courtroom. We're concerned with rules of law that will affect 300 million who aren't there. And no one knows if there'll be soundbite problems or not. So what I'm doing is sketching to you uncertainties on the other side. And I would remind you, as you well know, and people know at some level, we're just trustees. We're in part of an institution for a short time. That institution has a long life before us, and we hope a long life after us. And it is proved important to the American people. So we'll be very conservative as trustees and not jump into something without some evidence or reason to think that the good will outweigh the bad. And that's why I reach my question mark. I've always said and say it, and people turn it off because it sounds so boring, but I would actually like to see a little research done on what's happened in the states that have it and what's happened in states that don't and what the public attitudes are and to the extent to which it does promote understanding. And all that sounds boring, but as a trustee, I would hesitate to make up my mind without a little bit more information, which can be gotten.
It can be gotten indeed. You raised two issues I'd like to raise with you. One is that the Supreme Court justices are appointed for life. When that was originally decided, people did not live as long as we do, hopefully, now. Do you think that that decision, a lifetime appointment, still makes sense?
I think it has to be a long appointment. I don't really talk about this particular in the book for a reason that I actually think if it were a 15-year term or an 18-year term as opposed to a life term, it wouldn't matter. The important thing is to have a long term so that you don't have the judge thinking about his next job. And that's really the point. And it doesn't even say life in the Constitution. It says during good behavior. But it has been interpreted that way. You're right. And there we are. In any case, it would probably require, I don't know if Congress or the Constitution is going to be amended for that, but I do think a long term is important. And I won't get into an argument about whether it should be 15 years or 18 years or life or whatever. That is not a matter, I think, of great importance compared to what is important, which is what the court does and how it's done it and how it's gradually come to be accepted by the American public.
How would you describe your vision, your own particular vision, and that of so-called conservative jurists like Antonin Scalia?
Well, that's part of what I'm writing about. It's only part. And I'm writing about it because if I want to explain, as you would explain, how radio programs work, and particularly interview programs, you'll draw on your own experience because you see it through your own eyes. And here I think I can best explain the court through my own eyes. It's one judge. It's not necessarily a judge who has a monopoly of the right way to go about it. But I think that the problem is, why are you interested in this question? And it's a good question to be interested in. Because an awful lot of the people think that the way we decide important cases, politics. That's what they think. Junior league politicians. And a lot of what I'm writing here is to show that that is not the right way to describe it. Why did Alexander Hamilton want a Supreme Court? Why did he think a Supreme Court would have the last word as to the meaning of the Constitution in many cases? Because he couldn't think of where else to put that power. He thought if we give that power to the president, he'll be a tyrant. If we give it to Congress, well, they'll decide what's popular. They're experts at that. And why will they strike down a provision where it's unpopular to do that? And much of the Constitution is designed to protect people who are unpopular. All right, we'll give it to these judges. No one's heard of them. Totally obscure. not much power, not the purse, not the sword. We'll give it to them. And he never asked, if they're so obscure and have so little power, why will people do what they say? Well, part of the book's about that. But you see, I want to say it couldn't be politics. There'd be no reason for us to have the job if that's what it was. And it isn't either just every judge doing what he thinks is good, because if that were the law, if that's how we went about it, you'd have 9 different views, and probably with overtime you'd have 900 different views. And where I think the people who favor originalism, and I think Justice Scalia does, what they think is, look, there is a way of stopping judges from using their own subjective views of what's good.
You mentioned, Justice Breyer, the word originalism. I'd like to understand further what you mean, what others may mean by that.
Well, I think that most people will agree you can't have the judges just deciding things politically, and they shouldn't go off deciding everything, whatever they think is good. And originalism is a serious effort to try to control the subjective impulse of the judge by saying there's a way to answer these difficult questions by looking back to what the framers think. And my own view is that that doesn't work. I do think we should look back to see what values they were trying to protect. I think the value of free speech was not changed much, but I can't find the details. So my arguments, which are there are several here, as to why I think that doesn't work, one of them is what Justice Jackson said, trying to understand on a matter of detail what the framers thought is more difficult than interpreting the dreams of the Pharaoh. He said, Joseph had an easy time compared to that. If you want history, let's appoint 9 historians. And I can't, on really difficult matters of detail, find the answers in history. So then what do I suggest? I think what I do, if I were to describe it in general terms, is looking back into history a little further to where Gordon Wood, who's writing about the history of this republic, said in the 18th century and ever since, judges have described the difficult work of appellate judging as using prudence and pragmatism. And the great judges who I admire, Brandeis, Holmes, Learned Hand, have all tried to use something that can be generally described in that way. And what I've tried to do in a third of the book is to say that isn't a bumper sticker, and that isn't just a 4th of July speech. It can be given content in different areas of the law. And I try to explain enough so that people, without having to read the many, many opinions that have been written, which is too much for anybody to read, that people will be able to understand what I'm driving at, that that has real content. It can't be explained in 5 minutes, but it doesn't take thousands of pages either.
You call the Constitution a living document. Other people see it as it was written. It must stand. How do you reconcile the two views with a court made up of such disparate views?
Well, because they aren't as conflicting as you think. That is, I think that you look back to what the Constitution meant in 1789 when you're trying to figure out what is the basic value underlying words like interstate commerce, freedom of expression. That doesn't change. But what changes are conditions and circumstance.
Right.
They didn't think then about the internet. They didn't think about television. They didn't think about what interstate commerce would turn into. And the difficult problem for the judges is, how do you apply a constitution with unchanging values to a world that is continuously changing? How does free expression apply to the internet? Now, those are difficult questions, and you're not going to find the answer to that question in detail in what they thought then. As I say, some judges nonetheless believe we should try to look and find answers in that history. And others, like me, think it's not it's not going to work. But, it's a big country, and there are 300 million people, and They think a lot of different things, and the object of this document, the Constitution, is to allow 300 people of different races, religions, points of view, who think many different things, to live together in one government. And it's not a bad thing that people on the Supreme Court have different possible approaches. That isn't a bad thing. It's a good thing. I grew up in San Francisco. I lived most of my life in Boston. I thought I'd seen a lot of different points of view. And then I came down here and was on the court. I saw some points of view I hadn't seen before. And my first reaction is, oh, I'm right and they're wrong. That's a wrong reaction. The correct reaction is it's a fine and foreseen thing that with judges with a long term, you will get people of different basic points of view on the Supreme Court, and they'll have to live together and try to work things out together. And 30 to 40% of our cases are unanimous, and the 5-4s you read about are about 20 to 25%. And it isn't always the same 5 and the same 4. And it is not, in my opinion, politics. And it isn't either people trying to do what they think is good. Now, I'm trying to explain all that, and I have to admit, it takes a few pages to do it.
And you also concede in this book that the Supreme Court does make mistakes. And you cite the Dred Scott case as one of those mistakes. Here's an email from Kathleen, who says, I had the good fortune to sit in on part of the Supreme Court 2000 Bush v. Gore hearings in D.C. I lost all faith in the court after that politically partisan decision, she says. It appeared to be a Supreme Court judicial coup, not an election or a selection of former President Bush.
Well, I was in dissent in that case. I wrote, I didn't think we should have heard it. I thought we should dismiss it rather than decide it. And if we were to decide it, which we did, that in my opinion, the recount should have gone forward in Florida. So I thought it was wrong. But I use that case in the book. And what I want to show is this. Remember the question we started with? Why would people follow what a court says? Why would they do it? And I use Hotspur's question. You remember that? In Henry IV, Owen Glendower says, I can summon spirits from the vasty deep. And Hotspur says, well, so can I. So can any man. But when you call them, will they come? I mean, why follow the court, which could be wrong? And we had a president, Andrew Jackson, who when the court said that northern Georgia belongs to the Cherokee Indians, which it did, he didn't follow it. He said, John Marshall's made his decision. Let him enforce it. He sent the troops to evict the Indians. And they traveled the Trail of Tears to to Oklahoma, where their descendants still live. And then we had a president, Dwight Eisenhower, who after the court said there will be no more segregated schools. And a judge in Little Rock said, integrate that high school. And the governor said, no, he wouldn't. Eisenhower sent the 101st Airborne to escort those children into the school. That was a great day for law, and it was a great day for America. And now, back to the point. I heard Harry Reid, Senator Reid, say the following about Bush v. Gore, and it rang a chord. He said the most remarkable thing about that case is something that's very rarely remarked. It is that despite the fact that half the country, at least, thought it was wrong, and in my opinion, it was wrong, despite that, there was no violence in the streets, and people accepted it. Now, I'll tell you, I run into people, because I say that to people in audiences. I want people to understand this matter, and I'll run into a few who will say, it's too bad there wasn't violence. Too bad. And I'll say, you really think that? Turn on the television set. Go look and see what happens in places where there is violence. And now look at what we've done. What we've done is have a court of 9 fallible human beings, very fallible. I understand that being one of them. And they can make mistakes. But their job is there to try to enforce the Constitution even when it's unpopular to do so. And I see in front of me people of every race, religion, point of view, and they have decided to resolve their differences under law and not through violence in the streets. And even when I am most depressed and I am most in dissent, I think of that point, and I think still the country has a treasure in this system of law run by fallible but independent judges.
What about the Dred Scott case?
Well, I guess your last email person might disagree with this, but in my opinion, Dred Scott was the worst, the worst. It was a case before the Civil War, and the court held that the descendant of a slave, a black man, was not a citizen, could not be a citizen, was not a person who could bring a suit in a court. And on the way to saying that, what they said was that the Missouri Compromise was unconstitutional, that you could not take a slave away from a master, even in a free state or free territory. And my goodness. Now, two things about that. One, the most you could say for it, if you're looking for something good to say about it, is that Chief Justice Taney thought by saying this he would avoid a civil war. Well, if that's what he thought, he sure was wrong, and it shows how bad politicians judges are. The other thing is there was a great dissent. It was a dissent written by Benjamin Curtis from Massachusetts, and he just point by point showed how wrong it was. That dissent was picked up by President, not then president, but Abraham Lincoln. And Abraham Lincoln used it as the foundation for his Cooper Union speech, which helped catapult him to leadership in the Republican Party and helped elect a government that was not a slave-favorable government and led to the Civil War, perhaps, and ended up with a victory that ended slavery. So I like that dissent. I like that dissent.
That dissent,
yes.
Because it takes us to a better place.
No, that isn't why. It did, and I'm glad it worked out.
Ultimately,
yes. But I like it because it shows the power of reason. It shows that reason matters in an opinion. Because the Taney decision, the majority decision, was wrong at the time. It was wrong in logic, it was wrong in law, and it was wrong then in law. And Curtis just shows that calmly, point by point.
It is remarkable that something like that can evolve into something else that ultimately has some good.
Yes, that's right.
More of my conversation with Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my 2010 conversation with Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. He had just released his book, Making Our Democracy Work, A Judge's View.
We're going to open the phones. You'll need to put on those headphones. And we'll go first to Clearwater, Florida. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you, Diane.
Certainly, sir.
Justice Breyer, this is an honor. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you.
I wanted to ask you a question and then maybe get to something that you brought up, Lincoln. It's related to him. Everybody, and I'm sure you are familiar with the speech he gave that began 7 years ago. And he ends that with the phrase, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Do you think we have that government?
Basically, I think so. That's what I know. There are lots of complaints about the political process. But if you look at the document, the Constitution, I think most of us today who work with it, I work with it, so we have some experience with it, will say the primary object of that document, the primary object, is to create institutions so that the people can decide democratically what kinds of cities, towns, and states and nation they want. And it's a special kind of democracy. It's a democracy that protects basic human rights, that assures a degree of equality, that divides power so no one becomes too powerful, three branches of federal government and federal and state governments, and it tries to guarantee a rule of law. But those basic elements are written into that document, and we on the court see those basic elements as boundaries. As boundaries, and those laws or actions which go beyond the boundaries are the actions that we, sometimes with great difficulty, decide are either inside the boundaries and permitted or outside and forbidden. And people focus on that, but they sometimes forget that we're at the boundaries and that in between those boundaries is a vast, vast area where the public, you and me as a citizen, because I can vote too, that we have to decide how to vote, and we have to decide what kind of city, town, state, and federal government we want. Now, that's hard work. It's hard work. It requires participation. It requires what you're doing, which is to think about the flaws in the system at present, and then you have to think, how are we going to cure them? And then you have to convince others, and the way we get something done is by thinking about it, learning about it, arguing about it, discussing it, maybe even sometimes not too civilly, though it should be civil, and trying to persuade others to come along. And it's Tocqueville said that. He said that in the 1830s. He said the first thing he notices in America is the clamor. Well, what's that? The clamor is everybody arguing, but out of all those little groups, cities meetings, town meetings, seminars in universities, newspaper articles, letters to the editors, congressional hearings.
But what about in the Supreme Court closed door?
I know that's something that bothers you. And it bothers you quite a lot. In the Supreme Court closed door, which will remain closed, is when we discuss our arguments.
Discuss or argue?
Discuss. I've never, never, never in 16 years heard a voice raised in anger in that room. I have never heard one justice say something deprecating or insulting of another. Those discussions are civil and professional, and always, always. And people have very different points of view. What good would it do to start shouting? The other person would just think he was right, and we don't do it. And it is a tremendous virtue of that discussion session.
David, thanks for your call. And we have a follow-up from one of our earlier emails. Kathleen says, if Justice Breyer is claiming that the Supreme Court is not politically partisan, how do you explain the Bush v. Gore decision, if not based on political partisanship? And I must tell you, there were lots of emails to that effect.
Well, I can tell you what the presumptions that I start with. I dissented, didn't I? And I was appointed by President Clinton. And Vice President Gore was his vice president whom I'd met. And one could view my decision as favoring Vice President Gore. And I had to ask myself, I knew that, and I had to ask myself before reaching my conclusion, would I reach the same conclusion were the names reversed? So I tried to imagine that. And I went into that thought in my mind in depth. And I assume that others did the same. And there we are. I was asked that question at Stanford. And I said, I understand, I know what I did, I understand I'm human, and human beings can kid themselves. We're pretty good at self-kidding. So I have to do my best to try to make sure I'm not kidding myself and can only go so far. And that's what I said, and all that's truthful. And now, they ran a headline saying Justice Breyer thinks he was wrong in Bush v. Gore. That's not what I think. I think I was right. But I'm trying to make it as realistic so people understand it as possible. And that's why I want them to read how we do decide things. And then if they want to say there's an element sometimes of some political or value thing that enters in, fine. But they're not going to be able to say what it is all politics. They'll have a realistic understanding that the basic
far more nuanced.
That's what I want.
Let's go to Woodstock, Illinois. Good morning, Lydia.
Good morning to you both.
Thank you.
I have a question. By now, many people know that the Citizens United that we are currently talking about is based on a Santa Clara versus Southern Pacific Railroad case, and it is an issue for me because the court's opinion never took place in that procedure. If I could just read the clerk's statement that the Supreme Court utilized to declare that corporations were persons. This is a very short paragraph, and I'd like your opinion, please. The court, quote, "The court does not wish to hear the argument on the question whether the provision of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which forbades a state to deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws applies to these corporations. We are all of the opinion that it does. Does this clerk's preface, a note that was inserted in the procedures, count as a ruling? And is it to correct? Is it correct to say that the Citizens United case that we are currently talking about can be based on this procedure? Thank you."
Well, that's an interesting question. I dissented in Citizens United. John Stevens wrote a long dissent of 75 pages or so that incorporated the ideas of the four of us. Now, what you're referring to there is a very old case, and it has to do with the 14th Amendment, where it says no person can be deprived of liberty, life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And for purposes of that clause, it's been long established that corporations can be persons who could be deprived of property unconstitutionally. That doesn't have that much to do with the case in front of us, which was really a First Amendment case. And the question was whether freedom of speech protected the corporate contribution. And five people thought it did, and four people thought it did not. Now, there have been several cases where I've dissented pretty strongly, and what I do, and I think when we dissent strongly, you can't shout, you have to be civil, and you have to be reasoned.
What do you think is the impact of that court decision?
God, I didn't think it was desirable. That's what John Stevens said. But you remember, as I've said, some of these present close questions, and the people who are on the other side, the majority, those who have been on the court a long time on the majority, have always written and thought that the First Amendment's protection of free speech prevents Congress from regulating campaign finance. And their reason basically is, although money is not speech, you certainly need money to communicate in a political campaign. And don't get into the business of saying who can contribute and who can't. Now, I myself have not agreed with that argument. I have very elaborate and strong, I think, convincing reasons as to why that argument doesn't carry the day where there are a large number of people who can make huge contributions. And I've explained why I think the Constitution permits that regulation. But I just want the listener and others to understand, like many questions, there are two sides. And obviously, I think my dissenting side is the right side, but others on the other side don't.
How does it feel to be on the dissenting side as much as you have been of late?
You say of late, because, I mean, when Justice O'Connor was there, the last year she was there, I think I was in the majority more than probably anyone else. And I have dissented more. And the way it feels is, I got this question comes up in various forms. Some student asked me once, well, do you get depressed. I said, what if I had, no. I said, because it was about Arthur Goldberg, whom I clerked for that particular seminar. Hmm. And I said, what would he have told me? He'd say, depressed, what business do you have being depressed? Really, you sit there and write, do your best. And I'll go back and tell Joanna, my wife, in the next case, it's another day, and I'll say, I've written a dissent. It won't be a dissent. It's going to convince everybody. And she says, I've heard that one before. and so maybe it won't.
Why well, then I'll write so real?
Right, that's right. That's right. So, but you, that's another very, very good informal practice of the court. Tomorrow is another day. You and I might have been totally opposed on one case, and that fact has nothing to do with the next case. On the next case, we may be great allies, and tomorrow is another day. And that's, I think, the correct attitude that I try to have.
There are a number of people asking how you felt about the State of the Union address that President Obama delivered, with his passing reference and criticism of the court and the response from the Chief Justice.
Well, I'm used to people saying whatever they think about the court. My job is to write opinions and decide cases, and it's up to other people to decide what they will or will not say, whether they approve or not. But as far as the State of the Union is concerned, I think it's important we go to the State of the Union. Very important, and I'll continue to go. And the reason that I think it's important to go is people today, and now you may say since we're on radio, unfortunately, but people today learn more and more from what they see, and they're watching that television. And the State of the Union is a moment when in front of them are leaders of all the branches of the federal government, the President of the United States, the members of Congress, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Cabinet, and I think the judges should be there too, because I want people to see that, even if what they say is, who are those odd men and women in black robes? Then they'll learn something about it, and they'll find out something about the court and why courts are important to them.
I have a personal issue I'd like to raise with you. How would you feel about a non-lawyer on the Supreme Court?
Well, normally I think it's good to have diversity of background. I'm glad there are women on the court. I'm glad it's diverse. Would you best sort of push that with a non-lawyer? I think, I mean, it would depend on who it was. I think a non-lawyer would have a pretty tough time. I don't think there's ever been a non-lawyer.
No, I know there hasn't.
I'd have a pretty tough time.
You know, my husband is a lawyer, and I have argued with him about so many principles of law because they have not taken into account the humanity behind the law.
Well, there you should. The very purpose of law, the very purpose of it, is to have a set of rules and practices and cases and all kinds of precedents and things that help people in society get along better and achieve their objectives, productivity, peace, and so forth, more effectively. That's why there are laws. So if you come across a decision, or I come across a decision, that looks as if this decision and this interpretation is really going to work out badly for everybody, you ask yourself twice, am I sure? And the hardest thing about being an appellate judge, I mean, sometimes it does, because Congress passed this law, and there we are. You're sort of stuck with it. But you have to think hard about those things. The judges in an appeals court spend the day in a room. And in that room, there is a word processor to write, and there are a lot of things to read. And therefore, I think it's a good idea that they're appointed a little later in life after they have some other experience. And I think they have to use their imagination and understanding to try to understand how people who aren't in that room, all kinds of people, will be affected by their decision. And that's normally relevant to the question of law. So you say, is it okay? There have been governors who've been on the court. There have been former senators. And now you say, you poor to push it, a non-lawyer. So I'll just stop by saying that non-lawyer is going to have a tough time.
All right.
The others have worked out.
I accept. Here's an email. Can Justice Breyer discuss the idea of activist judges? Wasn't the recent reversal of the 100-year precedent regarding corporate money in elections simply judicial activism from the Roberts Court?
No, I tend to think the word activist is a kind of buzzword insult. If you don't like something, you say it's an activist. I once looked up the origin. I think it may have come from an article in Look magazine by Arthur Schlesinger Jr. in 1948, where he was describing Black and Douglas as activist because they, and he described Frankfurter as more in judicial restraint. Well, I think everybody in today's court's probably pretty much in favor of a degree of restraint. And then it was used against Earl Warren when there was desegregation. I remember those signs, "Don't you impeach Earl Warren."
Absolutely.
Well, you should have looked at the conditions. Absolutely. Then. I mean, look at the conditions. It were terrible, the conditions of segregation. But in any event, that isn't today's court. And today, if it's a question of who tends to uphold the laws of Congress the most, I think that probably I'm pretty high up on the list.
Let's go now to Rochester, New York. Good morning, Keith. You're on the air.
Yes, Justice Breyer's stating of Dred Scott is good enough, but like modern-day thinking people, he does have the advantage of hindsight, even if we agree that if he were living in the 19th century, he still for himself would think that way. But Justice Taney, like it or not, represented the majority of thought in the country, and yes, you will always have that Massachusetts justice writing for the minority. I feel that we modern people in our times, we judge too harshly all of those who went before us and in our terms today might have made regrettable decisions. I don't think Justice Breyer takes that into due enough consideration.
All right, Keith, thank you.
Well, as to Taney, you make a really interesting point. And what I've tried to do here, I understand I see things through our modern lens. You're absolutely right. But what I've tried to do is go back and read the opinions that were written at the time and try to imagine myself in the shoes of the judges who wrote them. And so that's what I found interesting about the opinions in Dred Scott. That's one of the things. It was that in terms of the logic at the time, see, for example, well, famous. You see, Taney wrote that the descendant of the slave, a black man, had no rights that a white man need respect. Now, that was a pretty shocking thing to say. And at the time it was. You can't find another Supreme Court opinion where people used language like that. It was inflammatory. Yeah. Or if you look back and see he said, well, their property, the slaves are property, and you can't deprive a person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and so you can't take the slaveholder's slaves away. And then Curtis says, well, let's look back. Let's look back to the time of the Constitution. Let's look back to the history where free states did take slavery away, and the founders thought that, and they got that language from the Magna Carta, and nobody thought those laws violated the Magna Carta. See, it requires a little imagination. So you go back, see it, read those opinions yourself, and see what you think.
Thank you, sir, for your continuing efforts to educate us about the law and the Supreme Court.
Thank you very much.
That was Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. We spoke about his book, Making Our Democracy Work, A Judge's View, back on October 7, 2010. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Sandra Baker, and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.